From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. High unemployment, wage stagnation, global uncertainty, a depression. My guest today, economist Paul Krugman, says we're right in the middle of one. His prescription, increase government spending now, kick the Fed into more action now, help the 99% now. Paul Krugman says ignore the deficit hawks for now, be glad for a little more inflation. Americans are suffering, he says, and only the government is big enough, strong enough to set things right. This hour On Point, Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman's urgent take on how to fix the economy. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to spend and inflate to gear up the economy? Would that do it? Would that do it right? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Paul Krugman, professor of economics at Princeton University, columnist for the New York Times. He blogs at The Conscience of a Liberal. Winner of the 2008 Nobel Prize for Economics, he has a fiery new book out that goes on sale today. Its title, End This Depression Now! Paul Krugman, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Depression?
Yeah. Remember, the Great Depression was not all recession. There was a slump, then there was a partial recovery, then there was another slump, then there was another partial recovery, and then the war took us out of it. So a depression is an extended period when the economy is not doing what the economy is supposed to do, when there are not enough jobs, when people are suffering. And that's what we're in right now. This is not as bad as the Great Depression, but that's not much consolation. It is long. I mean, we've been in this thing for more than 4 years, and the job market is still terrible. And functionally, it's a depression. It has the same fundamental features as the Great Depression. Hopefully, luckily, not quite as bad, but still plenty bad.
The costs, long term of what we're going through.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, so right now we're probably. I mean, in a way, money is the least of it, but the U.S. economy is probably producing about $1 trillion less than it should. Right now, we're sacrificing roughly $1 trillion a year of just wasted capacity.
Of potential wealth.
That are sitting idle. Mm-hmm. Of potential wealth. And the Europeans about the same. So this is a big, big, loss. But even more important, human costs. We have levels of long-term unemployment. People who've been unemployed for more than 6 months, more than a year, that we haven't seen since the 1930s. That destroys lives. That leaves people unable to do any of the things they want to do. And it destroys wealth, too, in the long term, because workers who are not employed for a long time eventually sort of lose their connection to the workforce. Young people, the prospects for the young are terrible right now. Unemployment and underemployment among college graduates, recent college graduates, is unprecedented, again, since the 1930s, which is destroying, again, the human capital. So we're inflicting enormous damage on ourselves. And it's all gratuitous. The point of the book is to say, we actually could solve this quite quickly if only we were prepared to think clearly about it.
Short-term pain, long-term destruction. And you write this, Paul Krugman, you say, ending this depression could be, almost incredibly easy. Wow. Okay. How?
Most immediately, we need the government, for the time being, to spend more, not less. This is a time when government... people like to say, government can't create jobs. Sure it can. The government can employ people. It can create purchasing power. It can supply the necessary boost to the economy. What ended the Great Depression was a large fiscal stimulus program, otherwise known as World War II. It doesn't have to be a war. We could do it. At this point, we could definitely provide enough stimulus to make a huge difference and probably enough to basically get us out of this just by reversing the huge cutbacks that have taken place at the state and local level in the United States. So that's the first thing. But then the Federal Reserve can help. It needs to raise its inflation target. It needs to be aggressive about fulfilling the part of its mandate that says that it's supposed to seek maximum employment and not just obsess about inflation that is really not much of a threat.
Why?
So, mm-hmm. What I try to say in the book is this is really remarkably easy. We have a lot of information saying that if we just did these things, which would be mostly not painful at all, we would be back to more or less full employment in a very short stretch of time. This thing that we're going through, this nightmare for millions and millions of people is purely the result of bad thinking and bad politics.
You know, you've got a lot of followers shaking their heads right now out there across the country and saying, yes, yes, go Paul. And you know, there are an awful lot of other people saying, are you kidding me? We tried a stimulus. It didn't work. We've got a huge deficit and debt. We've got to cut them back. This is the time to rein in, as we're hearing a lot of from the GOP,
right,
not to spend more.
Right. And so that's why in this depression now, I spend a lot of time going through those arguments and going through the evidence. And the thing you need to bear in mind is that the people who say things like that, saying, well, you know, we really need to tighten our belts and who are worried about debt right now as opposed to job creation, they've made a lot of predictions over the last several years, as have people like myself. And they've been wrong about everything. Right? They said that U.S. government borrowing was going to send interest rates sky high. In fact, U.S. government is now, as of this morning, was able to borrow long term at 1.9%, which is very near a historical low. They said that austerity programs like the ones that countries are carrying out in Europe would actually be expansionary because they would improve confidence and lead to more private spending. And take a look at what's happening in Europe right now, and you can see that that's not happening. There was a lot of warnings about runaway inflation, which has not manifested itself. So, you know, in a way, we can say, look, we've had a 3-year test under extreme conditions of your worldview versus the worldview of people like myself or Joe Stiglitz. And it's been pretty clear. It's been actually extremely clear which worldview works.
And still people look at American debt and deficit and fear it. Fear its impact right now and fear it long term. Don't want to become Greece. What do you say to the overhang phobia?
Well, a couple of things. First thing to say is we are not Greece. We have not had a long term. Greece is a country that has a long term history of fiscal irresponsibility, which we don't. They have a much heavier debt burden than we do, and they don't have their own currency, which makes a huge difference. The fact that we still have the dollar and our debt is in dollars means that we're largely immune to the kinds of crises of confidence that Greece and other European countries have faced. The other thing is, even if you are worried about debt and deficits, slashing spending right now doesn't even help on that front. You cut spending, well, sure, you've reduced spending, but then you also shrink the economy, which means that revenue falls, which offsets right there a large part, probably a majority of whatever savings you thought you got on the budget. It increases unemployment, which hurts the long-term capacity of the economy, which means that people who are now in the workforce will never come back into the workforce. It reduces the long-term economic growth of America. And since the growth of America is also the growth of the tax base, it's extremely likely, I'd say highly probable, that austerity measures are actually bad even in purely fiscal terms. They actually make you worse off. So to argue that, well, you know, I'm really scared about this debt, so let's destroy the economy, thereby destroy the tax base, that's not an argument you really want to be listening to.
I want to come back and poke at a lot of these and hear you out in more detail, because people are so focused on so many of these elements, the stimulus, inflation, deficit, what might be done here. You said it could be done, and it would be relatively easy to turn this around. But you write this, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. You say, too many people who matter, and you're writing this in the new book, Out Today, End This Depression Now! Too many people who matter, you write, Paul Krugman, politicians, public officials, and the broader class of writers and talkers who define conventional wisdom have, for a variety of reasons, chosen to forget the lessons of history and the conclusions of several generations' worth of economic analysis, replacing hard-won knowledge with ideologically, politically convenient prejudices. For a variety, why would people, if you're right, why would people want to forget all this? Why?
There's a couple of things. I guess I'm saying that a lot, but there are multiple reasons for almost everything going on here. So part of it is political. They have a powerful right-wing movement, which is committed to the view that government can never do anything good, because if we say the government can do something good, then they might say, well, you know, to pay for those things, we might actually have to tax rich people and corporations, and we don't want to do that.
But surely, so even if you have that political view, you don't want the United States in a depression, as you call it. Surely.
But they've spent decades, they actually spent generations campaigning against the kind of economic analysis that I use in this depression now. They've campaigned against it because they thought that if people believe that the government can ever do good any time, then that's the thin end of the wedge to a larger role of government and, in the end, taxes on their sponsors. Not so easy to say, okay, wait, this time is different and we're going to, you know, we've been kidding about all that, and, you know, really, that right now we need government intervention. So they're kind of trapped in a construct that was originally designed to serve their self-interest, but is, you know, now they can't get
out
of it.
When you say their self-interest, what interest does that mean?
Well, think about, you know, if we want to talk about the right-wing think tanks, which play a big role, like it or not, play a big role in the shaping of our discourse. They really are financed by a relatively small number of billionaires. I mean, everybody's now talking about the Koch brothers. There are others. But we really are talking about a small group of wealthy people financing a network that has done a lot to define our conventional wisdom.
And they would want to keep the United States in economic distress?
They have spent 50 years campaigning against any theory, any possible role for government. And if you imagine that they are, meanwhile, privately thinking, well, actually, we actually do believe in Keynesian economics, people are not that subtle. People who spent a long time campaigning on what is in their short-term interest are not going to be able to turn around and say, oh, well, actually, you know, this theory we've been trashing, it's actually true, and so we really need it right now. So, they established a backdrop against which you can't act.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with economist Paul Krugman about saving the U.S. economy, he says. Nobel Prize-winning liberal champion says we're in a depression, but it can be ended. He says spend now, pay down the debt later, or the suffering will go on. His new book out today is End This Depression Now. He joins us from New York. Paul, let me go straight to some listeners. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Matthew, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think?
Well, I'm a political science major. I'm going to be graduating here in a week. And I've done a lot of research in international political economics, and I definitely agree with your guest on, you know, IMF conditionality and austerity measures, how it's not an investment that can give you any return to improve the economy. But if you borrow a lot, I want to know how your listener would, you know, how he reacts to the fact that if you borrow a lot, the interest payments on that debt are going to be, they're going to be taken out of future income, and that income is something that could, you know, the interest payments could go towards education and infrastructure, stuff like that. So doesn't it balance out that the short-term loans right now are going to have to be paid back in the future, and it's going to do just as much damage as we're fixing with the loans?
Matthew, let's put it to the economist. Paul, what do you say?
Okay. First thing you have to bear in mind is just how cheap federal borrowing is right now. Right, it's 1.9%. If they've got, you can buy inflation-adjusted, inflation-protected bonds. The interest rate on those is actually negative. People are actually willing to pay the U.S. government to hold their money safe. So there's really very little cost in terms of future interest payments right now. That's not always going to be true, but it is true right now. The other thing to say is that we are in a depression now. We won't always be. In the future, when we have to make whatever we do to deal with our budget, some combination of spending cuts and tax increases, it won't have the same depressing effect on the economy in the future because when we do it, which will be after the economy is recovered, the effect of those things can be offset by having the Federal Reserve cut interest rates. The distinguishing feature of where we are right now is that short-term interest rates is what the Fed controls are zero. They can't cut interest rates anymore, which is why cutting spending right now is very destructive to the economy in the way that cutting spending or raising taxes at a later date would not be. So it's this very difference. You have to – the beginning of wisdom in all of this stuff is to understand that we are in a special situation where a lot of the usual rules don't apply, but not a situation we haven't seen before. It's just a situation where you have to see, look, all of the things you might want in normal circumstances to do – are not something you really want to do now. This is a depression, and making the economy even more depressed doesn't solve anything.
But what about the other things that we have seen before? I think it's Paul Samuelson who writes that every time we have an emergency, be it war or economic challenge, government's role grows, and it's grown and grown. And so people are not so confident that on the other side of a stimulus, it'll be rained back in. What about that concern, Paul?
Except it's not true. That's one of those things that people talk about, but the reality is that size of government hasn't changed much for quite a long time. The reality is that in this slump, far from seeing an expansion of the role of government, we've actually seen unprecedented cutbacks in government employment. A big story in the Washington Post this morning about that, but I write about it at length in End This Depression Now. So this is, people stroke their chins and say very wisely, well, start a stimulus, and the stimulus will never be withdrawn, it'll become permanent. That's not what just happened. What just happened was we got a way inadequate stimulus, which was withdrawn and then more than withdrawn. That the notion that we're locking in a bigger role of government, that's just mythology. It's a self-serving mythology of the political right, and it's utterly at odds with our actual experience.
Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana, and Akshat. Akshat, you're on the air with Paul Krugman. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom. My question for Professor Krugman is regarding Europe. So it seems to me the case against stimulus in the United States is that it wouldn't be worth the costs, and the borrowing costs would soon rise, basically because of the confidence vary. Now, I think that's a weak case, as Professor Krugman points out, because costs are extremely low for the U.S. government. But what about borrowing costs for countries like Britain or Spain or Greece? It seems to me the case for stimulus there is much more difficult to make. So we're not Greece, as he points out, but should countries like Greece pursue more stimulus, and would that work?
That's interesting.
Okay. By the way, your listener just one of I think my enduring contribution to the language of economics is the confidence fairy, because a lot of arguments
not theory but fairy the confidence fairy.
A lot of people believe that you can cut government spending and somehow the economy will expand, not contract, because confidence will come in. I say that's believing in the confidence fairy, which has repeatedly refused to make an appearance in all of this stuff. Britain, actually.
I think you need to explain what you mean there. The theory was go with austerity. That will give confidence to people who would buy bonds and support the debt of these countries.
Just buy bonds, but actually spend. Businesses and consumers will say, the deficit's under control. So now I'm confident in the future of my country, and I will go out there and spend more. Mm. And that would more than offset the direct negative hit from the cut in government spending. This was the serious theory. This was more or less official dogma at the European Central Bank and among a lot of conservatives both sides of the Atlantic. And we've seen what actually happens, and the confidence fairy never appears. Countries that have done big austerity, like Ireland, have seen nothing but economic pain. There's been no recovery in confidence. So that's there's the evidence is pretty clear that this was a false doctrine.
But we did see investors begin to pull away from these countries and the crisis that engendered.
Huge difference. Britain is a nice example because Britain, like the United States, has its own currency, has debt in its own currency. Britain has never seen any pressure from the bond markets. When the British say, well, we must have austerity, this is not based on anything that has actually happened. It's all based on the imagination of the Cameron government, which thinks that things will happen to it if it doesn't have an austerity program. And in fact, it's the wrong thing. In Britain, they're almost certainly actually hurting themselves even in fiscal terms by having a premature austerity program. Countries like Greece, I mean, Greece is actually – I really hate Greece as an example because they are the uniquely bad example. I talk about the Hellenization
of our
economic
discourse. Because they lied and messed up
their – lied and they ran big budget deficits even in the good times, which is not true of anybody else. It's not true of Spain. It's not true of Portugal. It's definitely not true of Ireland. So the Greeks are a special bad case. Question, what can a country like Spain do? Very difficult because they're on the euro, because they don't have their own currency. That produces huge constraints. And so if we're asking what can the prime minister, or better still, Portugal, what can the prime minister of Portugal do? Well, he's got nothing much he can do except for the nuclear option of actually going off the euro, which they're understandably reluctant to do, although may be forced to eventually. So in the case of Europe, we need to be talking about Europe-wide policy.
Let's talk
the policy
about
of the Europe. Yeah.
If we may, to bring it back home for a second, because the European model, it may be different, but it's been rolled out a lot in the American debate over this. And here's some tape, Paul, of House Republican budget plan being released. This was in March. And Congressman Paul Ryan, of course, right at the lead on that. And he was warning here about the perils of growing national debt in this country. And here's Ryan saying that President Obama's budget plan would do nothing to address that debt.
The debt still skyrockets under his plan, and it will put us on par with countries like Greece. That will mean sudden cuts to benefits, sudden tax increases, and really a fundamental change to the American way of life as we know it.
Complete with organ music in the background, but there's that button being pushed. We will go down the Greek road.
Right, and it's been very destructive. I think people have used the Greek example to justify all kinds of things. The real lesson of Europe that's relevant to us is we see what happens if you do fiscal austerity while the economy is still depressed. Take a look at Ireland. Ireland has done everything that the right wing in this country wants the United States to do. They have low taxes on corporations. They have huge spending cuts. They were supposed to get a big reward, and in fact, not once but twice since their austerity program began, they've been hailed as a success story based on, you know, very flimsy evidence. But there they are with 15% unemployment and 30% youth unemployment. It's not working there. Interesting that Ryan would, you know, I've been trying to tell people this. Ryan is essentially a flim-flam artist. If you look at his own budget, if you look at the stuff that's actually specified, it's nothing but tax cuts for the rich and benefit cuts for the poor that would actually on net increase the deficit. And all of his claims of deficit reduction are based upon empty promises about ways that he will save money unspecified. So the reality is that he's not a real deficit hawk. He's just pretending to be one so that he can sell what is basically a political agenda. The Obama budget is reasonably responsible. In fact, I wish it was doing more spending right now, which would have very little impact on the long-run debt position, possibly positive even because of the things I've been talking about, and would do a lot more to help employment right now. But the Republicans are they're just rolling out grease. It's like the monster under the bed. They're telling scare stories to try to frighten us into going with their agenda, and it's based on nothing.
Okay, let's hear more, Paul, if you would, about what you would actually do if you could wave the wand. What would it look like? The Krugman response to where we are right now. You said spend more before. Well, that's history. Here we are. What would you do?
In some ways, technically, it's actually a lot easier than it was 3 years ago. 3 years ago, when we were talking about a stimulus. We were talking about, you know, where are the projects? What are we going to spend the money on? We don't actually need big new projects right now because what's actually happened is the reverse of stimulus. What we've actually had is huge cutbacks at the state and local level.
You mean layoffs?
Layoffs. Well, and cutbacks in other spending too. Mm-hmm. You look at actually spending on roads, on other infrastructure, big cutbacks. We're hundreds of billions of dollars below where the normal growth in state and local spending would have taken us. We're about 1.3 million jobs in the public sector below what normal growth along with population would have taken us. So you can get a very large boost to the economy just by having another major package of federal aid to states and local governments so as to allow them to reverse those cuts, rehire those school teachers, rebuild those police departments, restart those road projects, fill those potholes that you stopped filling because you were trying to save a nickel here and there.
And what would that do?
Right there, you can get 1.3 million jobs straight up easily. You can get a boost to the economy that's probably 2 or 3% of GDP. You can get the unemployment rate below 7%, which I think would probably be enough to actually jumpstart a much broader recovery.
But you say don't stop there. You want the Fed to set higher targets for inflation. They've been shooting for 2%. You say make it 4. Ben Bernanke has said that wouldn't be prudent. Why do you say 4?
Because the fundamental problem with the economy, one way to say it, is that people are sitting on cash. Corporations are sitting on $2 trillion of cash. People are unwilling to borrow even if they have good projects. They're unwilling to invest in anything risky because there are risks. And sitting on cash looks like a fairly attractive strategy.
There's no inflation,
you want to make that strategy less.
Mm-hmm.
So inflation makes it less attractive to just sit on cash. It also somewhat reduces the overhang of debt, which is the result of bad decisions in the past. That's actually a very standard economics argument. It's an argument that has been made not just by me but by the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, and it was made 10 years ago quite forcefully for what Japan should do by a fellow named Ben Bernanke, who was at that point a professor at Princeton University. So all I'm saying is actually, you know, do what standard textbook economics says, do what the IMF says we should be doing, do what you yourself, Ben, used to say when you were a professor, because we really need this help. We are it's not prudent, put it this way. People have the wrong notion of prudence. They're saying doing something that you're not sure how well it will work. That's not an imprudent policy when the alternative is letting the economy sit there with massive unemployment and the destruction of millions of lives.
Ben Bernanke, I think, hired you at Princeton. He knows your history. You know his. Yeah. Last week, he was asked to respond. You know, you've been going after him pretty hard, saying he's been consumed by the Borg, thinking back to Star That's Trek right. and Captain Picard. Right. But he responded here to you pushing for higher inflation.
Does it make sense to actively seek a higher inflation rate in order to achieve a slightly increased pace of reduction in the unemployment rate? The view of the committee is that that would be very reckless.
Very reckless. And he's talking about you, Paul Krugman, what you're proposing here.
Well, it's kind of funny. I thought that was a very weak response on his part. I mean, he's not really offering a substantive argument, and he's doing stuff, you know, a slight improvement in the rate at which we're reducing unemployment. Boy, I mean, if we look at the writings, again, of one Ben Bernanke on monetary policy, you'd think that the effect would be a lot bigger than that. So he's loading the dice. That sounded to me like he's been forced into taking a position that is kind of the institutional position of the Fed, which is a comfortable one, which is, well, we've done all we can. What more can we do?
But what do you mean he forced? He's the boss over there. He's the chairman.
Well, it's not that way. I mean, actually being chairman of the Federal Reserve, at least in this time, is a little bit more like being chairman of the Princeton Economics Department. You're not so much the boss as somebody who's trying to herd cats. And I understand that he may, in his deepest heart, actually believe something quite different from what he said, but feel that he just can't sell it to his colleagues. But
is he intimidated by politicians, Paul?
Or by politicians,
I mean,
both.
Who was it, Rick?
Rick
Texas?
Perry, who said something ugly could happen to him if he came to Texas.
Yeah.
No, he's under. And by the way, my sense is. I feel I'm doing him a favor. I'm actually giving Ben Bernanke
some
pressure from the left that he can use to wave against the pressure from the right. Because at this time, until now, all of the harassment has been from the people who want him to do even less than the Fed is now doing. But so I'm giving him some pressure to do more.
But your conservative critics say, please, no, Krugman, we don't want this inflation. What do you want, Zimbabwe? You want the Weimar Republic here? Inflation run amok on the other side of stimulus and
that. I think anybody who brings up Zimbabwe should be considered to have automatically lost the argument. I mean, we're talking 4% inflation, maybe. Gee, when did we last have 4% inflation? During Ronald Reagan's second term. Do you remember people paying for their groceries with wheelbarrows full of cash? Right. We're talking about very modest things.
No, but I do remember interest rates up at 17% somewhere in that.
That was before.
Early 80s.
That was
okay.
That was at the beginning. That was when we were crushing. We had 13% inflation, and it took high interest rates to bring that down. But we're not talking about that now. We're talking about modestly higher inflation. And again, this is a really respectable position. There's been a lot of back and forth among economists since my piece on Bernanke, which just articulated what a lot of people are saying. And I think the majority opinion, at least among the people I've been reading and talking to, is that Bernanke is making a very weak case and that the economics is all on my side here.
But if it's so clear and if the health of the entire country's economy, maybe the world's, is resting on this, it's still kind of hard to believe that somebody like Ben Bernanke would say, oh, never mind.
Well, except if you look at history. I mean, Ben Bernanke wrote a scathing attack on the Bank of Japan back in 2000 about the self-induced paralysis of the Bank of Japan and its failure to do what was needed to get the Japanese economy moving, which was a pretty good description of the psychology of it, and it fits the Fed perfectly right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with economist Paul Krugman about saving the U.S. economy. The Nobel Prize-winning liberal champion says we're in a depression, but it can be ended relatively easily, he says. He says spend now, pay down the debt later, or the suffering will go on. Paul, here's Nancy on Twitter. She says, rereading Grapes of Wrath, feeling stunned at parallels to today, so grateful to FDR, agree with Krugman 100% from Nancy tweeting there. But here's Worried for the Country, says, hey, Dr. Krugman, we need more government spending. We're already at 24% of GDP, the highest since World War II, so we need more military spending, more Solyndra, more GSA conferences.
Gosh. Again, the Solyndra and GSA, those are signposts that you're not serious, right? Solyndra was a small loan that went bad, which is relative to the size of the issues. The GSA conference, that's trivial. That's somebody there. But anyway, the reason that spending is high relative to GDP is partly the GDP is depressed. You know, you have a given set of government programs, the economy falls out from under you. Those programs look bigger relative to the economy. As for the rest, we're spending more on food stamps and unemployment insurance. Guess why? Because we have a lot of people in desperation. If you look at the underlying set of programs that we have, they're actually smaller, not bigger than they were before all of this started. So this is just, you know, I guess this is a line that it demonstrates the problem you were asking earlier. Why don't people see the obvious? Well, part of the answer is there are these cheap shots that proliferate in the public debate. You know, spending must be corrupt. We've had, you know, 40 years now of people constantly campaigning on the notion that everything government does is wrong and corrupt. And then we reach a moment where we desperately need the government to act. And all many people can do is think in terms of these cliches.
I want to come back to that tension. You've been right in the fire of it. But let's hear from listeners first. Mark in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on with Paul Krugman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm one of those people who believed or hoped that President Obama would just sort of take on whatever Paul Krugman said when he became president. Mm. And I was disappointed that he didn't. I'm calling because I wanted to remind everyone of a study from May of last year where Hamilton College looked at, I think, 26 pundits and politicians and so on, and rated them 1 to 5, accurate or not accurate. And Paul Krugman came out on top as most accurate.
So let's give him the grade and remember. Mark.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, thank you for that. That was a little study. But let's make it not personal. Let's say that people who have the view of the economy that I have, which is economy jargon, is ISLM when the liquidity trap. Anyway, never mind. But the basic view that leads you to believe that this is a time to spend, have had a spectacularly good track record in terms of predicting what was going to happen in this slump. The predictions about interest rates, the prediction about inflation, the predictions about the effects of austerity measures have been right. Whereas if you, let's say, got your notion of how the economy works and what was going to happen from reading the Wall Street Journal editorial page, you would have been wrong about everything. And I think that should count some in terms of the discussion of what we do now. Why should we be taking advice from the people who've gotten everything wrong? Why not actually listen a bit to those of us who pretty much got it right?
Watch the record as we go. Let's go to Gretchen in Canandaigua, New York. Gretchen, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering what Professor Krugman would think about an idea like this, sending a stimulus check to each and every American by taking that bank bailout amount, which I believe is $7 billion, and divide it by every single person in the United States and send it to us. I think we would figure out what to do with it, and we would be able to solve the mess.
A lot more than $7 billion, but I mean...
$700 billion, but yeah. The trouble was that wasn't actually a net expense, right? The government claims to have broken even. There's some funny accounting there, but most of that money will be repaid. So it's not... But look, if you could... It's not the ideal stimulus I would want. I think we should be rehiring those school teachers and filling in the potholes and finishing the tunnel under the Hudson River, which is personally very important to me. But we should be doing all of those things by preference. But sure, if we could put it would be, you know, like 10th or 11th on my list of good ways to do it. But sending a lot of checks to every American, or even better, to those Americans in the lower part of the income distribution would be one way to get a significant stimulus. And anything that pushes us in that direction would be a good thing right now.
Paul, we've got people who just don't believe that if you bring in stimulus that the economy is going to behave as it has in the past. That people think we've got real structural problems here. And some of them with a pretty tough kind of cultural edge on them. Here's a listener online writes, Paul, you seem to ignore 30 years of dumbing down the population. We've lost our willingness to work. We've lost the public education that used to prepare kids for a working career. There are thousands of underperforming schools. Millions of children, young adults can't write, manipulate numbers, not qualified for 21st century jobs. And then the zing, why reward them with more handouts when they do not want to do the hard work of getting educated? I mean, even if you don't go with the sort of whiplash at the end there, what about this concern that the American population, you can pour in the ingredients, but we just don't have the education these days to make it happen here?
Yeah, we had a couple of things. We had more or less full employment, you know, not that long ago, 5 years ago. It wasn't the perfect economy, but the idea that somehow we've lost the ability to do productive work that we had as recently as 2007, That doesn't sound right. If American workers are so hopeless, how come we still have pretty much the highest labor productivity in the world? We're not as much better than other countries as lots of Americans like to imagine, but we're still pretty good on that front. And if you study, we talk about studying the Great Depression. Every argument that people are making now about why we can't possibly have a recovery until we rip up the economy at the roots and start all over, that was made in the 1930s. You can find tons and tons of articles from 1935, 1936 saying, or 1938, 1939 saying that, look, we American workers just don't have the skills that are needed for this 20th century economy,
really?
And so we can't recover. And then along came the military buildup to World War II, and all of those useless workers turned into Rosie the Riveter.
And off we went. Paul Krugman says it can be done without war. He says it could be done, should be done, relatively easily if we would just do the spending to do it. There's big pushback against that, but he's been banging away. And at this point, he's got some track record within these years of recession. He says depression. Andrew in Bristol, Connecticut, you're on the air, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay. What do you think?
I just wanted to challenge Paul. I understand where he's coming from with having the government spend to stimulate the economy. However, I feel that, as an earlier caller stated, if the government wasn't taking the money from the people, that the people would be able to find a way to spend their own money in order to stimulate the economy, as in a way of eliminating the federal income tax or greatly reducing federal income tax. I feel that people would better allocate their own funds to stimulate the economy.
Let us pick it up. Paul, there's a big body of people out there these days who are saying that, and Paul Ryan says a version of that. Just get it in people's pockets. Let them make the decisions. We'll be better off.
Okay. We got a demonstration right now that people are, in fact, not willing to spend enough to get the economy moving, right? If you're saying that this can happen, why isn't it happening already? And there are some more specific things. If you actually ask what is holding back private spending right now, the answer is actually not the stories you hear. It's not lack of confidence, not fear of Obama. You can test that, and it's just not true. What we have is we have a large overhang of private sector debt. So people are obsessing about the public debt, but the actual drag on our economy right now is the level of private sector debt relative to income. During the Bush bubble years, we added to what was already a high level of consumer debt and built that debt up to a point where it is higher relative to income than at any time since the 1920s. So that's the big drag on the economy. Saying, well, let's just count on the private sector to do the spending is ignoring the downdraft that is provided by this debt that was run up by mistake when people believed that housing prices could never go down. And the question now is, how do we rescue this economy? Because it's one thing to say that we made some mistakes. The question is, how can we work our way out of it without mass unemployment, without just adding to the problem by having a persistently depressed economy?
A lot of people wonder why private enterprise isn't investing now. You know, we hear many Republicans saying it's because of uncertainty created by too much regulation and changing policies. Here's a listener online, Lou, says, simple question to ask Krugman. Tax breaks for corporate America. Is the intention to hire or hoard? H-O-A-R-D, hoard.
Yeah, and the point is, actually, business investment has been stronger than many people realize. Business investment is actually has made up a lot of the lost ground, although not all of it. The big collapse has been in housing investment, which is because we had a bubble and the bubble burst and people aren't ready to start that up again. But to the extent that businesses are sitting on a lot of cash, well, it's, you know, they're not using the capacity they have. There isn't enough demand to keep their factories running at full capacity. The office buildings are sitting with a lot of vacancies. Why would they be building more factories and office buildings? It's the depressed state of the economy that's holding business sector back, which is why corporate tax breaks, which, you know, I was on TV the other day, and there was Carly Fiorina saying we need lower corporate taxes, which is can we think of any circumstance in which she wouldn't say that? But the lower corporate taxes would actually do nothing right now. Corporations are flush with cash. they don't see a good reason to expand their capacity because the economy is weak, and campaigning for even more corporate tax breaks is not going to get us any closer to full employment.
What would a fuller or full employment America look like these days? You won your Nobel Prize for writing about international trade,
right,
globalization. We have, over time, lots of listeners calling in saying, we've got to have manufacturing back here or it's just not going to work. People told the service sector, but look where we are. We're working at McDonald's or not at all. Can we do it without manufacturing?
No, I mean, manufacturing is going to be a part of it. And by the way, manufacturing is one of the brighter spots in the economy right now.
Well,
it's still way down from where it should
yeah.
be, but it's one of the things that, you know, if you ask where has the unemployment rate fallen most rapidly in the United States, it's in the industrial heartland. It's in there in places like Michigan where the auto industry has made a pretty strong comeback thanks, by the way, to a much maligned bailout from the Obama administration. So, but more than that, sure, I think we're going to, over time, we're going to need to have a lot of reshoring of manufacturing, production coming back here. We're going to need to have more
exports.
How
do you do that? By wages going down here? By trouble in China? By some restrictions on trade?
You do
tariffs?
It. No. Primarily, you do it by having a strong economy which encourages investment here. You also have the labor cost issues are actually moving in America's favor. Wages are rising in China. China's not such a low-wage country anymore, given it's still low productivity. U.S. manufacturing is looking pretty competitive on a lot of dimensions. And if we have that kind of expansionary employment-oriented policy from the Fed that I've been advocating, you're also going to have a somewhat weak dollar, which makes U.S. industry more competitive. Not so hard. Back just before this crisis struck, back in 2007, mm-hmm. we were seeing really strong signs of a manufacturing revival in the United States. We were actually doing quite well. Mm. Then the world fell apart.
Yep.
But I think if we can have a recovery in the broader economy, which, as I've been saying, end this depression now, we can do that faster than anybody believes, we would also get back on track to that manufacturing revival.
Let's go to Plymouth, New Hampshire, and Maggie. Maggie, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yes, hi. My question, many would agree that there is consolidation of wealth and power, and how do we get past that when the decision makers in general would be the ones to benefit the least from your programs, from your plans?
Okay, yeah. So that's a really good question because the truth is that even the big corporations and even, by and large, the billionaires would be benefited by a full employment policy. But they would not benefit as much as the ordinary workers would. And to some extent, they're just suspicious of anything that doesn't tilt the balance further in their direction. I think part of – in a way, there's almost a kind of hope in the way that Wall Street has deserted Barack Obama for this election. Right? When he came in, there was a lot of people who were – who were, in retrospect, part of the problem, were also big supporters of the current administration. They had entree. They had a way mm-hmm. in. I think President Obama, people around him have figured out that these people are ultimately not their friends. I think we have some chance of doing a better job of taking on those interest groups. And it's not, we're not as much of a democracy as we like to imagine we are, but we're not a full-on oligarchy, at least not yet. So the voice of the people still matters.
Speak to that more. You've got an exclamation mark in your new book title, End This Depression Now.
Right.
But you're a pretty mellow guy today in this conversation. But we know, lots of people read you. We know you're fiery. You're fierce on this. There's clearly a battle that is underway here, and we're in the midst of it. You write in the book that it's the middle class which is on the line here, and more than that. But the battle of visions that gets your dander way up very regularly
right.
and that you describe as very real, what is it? What's the battle of interest, the battle of visions that Americans should understand themselves by your lights to be in the midst of here?
Okay, we have we've had a spiral of growing concentration of wealth and power at the top and of policies that increasingly serve that concentration of wealth and power at the top, which reinforces that concentration and then in turn increases their political power. On top of that, we have just plain the mismanagement of the crisis, which is connected to but not inseparable from the inequality of power and wealth. We need to work on both fronts. We need to get this economy moving again, which can be done technically quite easily, although there's huge political obstacles, but you need to confront them instead of just give up. And then while we're doing that and as we recover, we also need to work on making this back into the middle-class society we used to be. This book, End This Depression Now, is about mostly about the short run. It's about what should we do now, because the damage is ongoing as we speak, and we need to fight that. But by all means, let's move on trying to – let's try and do again what we did under FDR and make this back into a more just, more middle-class society.
But it sounds to me, reading in your book, that the path to that change may be blocked by exactly the political opposition you're writing about there. I mean, can you really solve the one without solving the other, to our caller's question?
Yeah, I think, again, the problem with our economy is much smaller than the scale of the damage would make you think. I used an analogy earlier in the book, early in End This Depression Now, where I say that it's like we have a $30,000 car that is motionless because it's got a dead battery. And fixing that dead battery, replacing it, should not be a hard task. We can do that.
So you say, but we're not. But you would. I've also watched this. We have not, at least, done what you've prescribed for years here.
That's why I'm writing a book to keep on hammering the point home. Because you keep on driving it home, and maybe eventually you get people in positions of influence to actually do what they should be doing.
Paul Krugman, professor of economics at Princeton University, Nobel Prize winner, writes the blog Conscience of a Liberal, columnist for the New York Times. His new book is End This Depression Now. Paul, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.